for this title. And he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Hello, everybody, this is Stephen Elson. This is The Warm Down, and today we've got a very special guest. We've got one of my favourite pundits. I mean, it really is. I think Gary Neville gets a lot of plaudits because Monday Night Football is a massive, massive show. But you know what? The top man working in football punditry at the moment for me is Danny Higginbottom. Danny, delighted to have you on The Warm Down. How are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thanks. Good to be here, and thanks for the nice compliments.
Well, I've tweeted you several times, and I saw you something that BT did at Hotel Football, and I think I've told you all of those times, like, it's my fucking favourite pundit, like... And we just spoke a little bit before we got started as well.
Yeah.
Your approach to it is very similar to my own approach with the stuff that I do with Full Time Devils or Sky or BT and stuff like that. Is I always try and look at the positive, and you yourself is almost word for word what you just said yourself. You try and find the good in what people have done, because obviously players, managers, everyone in this has got the best of interest at heart, aren't they? And sometimes the mistakes, they're just human mistakes, aren't they? Most of the time.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that it's important, like with what I do now as well, you want to build up contacts, because you want to be able to speak to managers, you want to be able to get advice from them in terms of the way that they see the game going in any particular game that you're doing. And I'll always say to them, you know, managers, first thing I want to do, I want to be positive. That's the only thing. Obviously, during the game, if there has to be criticism, you want to make it constructive. But more often than not, I just want to look at the positive side of things, because this is something I want to be in for a long time. And there's no doubt about it. Sometimes you can't get away from criticism, but I try and put myself in the position of a player. And if I'm saying something during a game, would I be able to handle that? You know, and I got criticism when I was playing it. It's part and parcel of football. And if I could take it, then I don't think there's a problem with me saying things. But by and large, I always try and be, you know, look on the complimentary side, look on the positive side, because like you just said, you know, nobody goes out on that football pitch wanting to have a bad game, wanting his team to lose when they're playing, or no manager sets his team up to lose. So it's just trying to look at things from a different angle.
Was there any other criticism that you got when you was a player that you really took to heart, that really got under your skin?
No, not really, because I think as a youngster in football, I think, like, if you had a game on the Saturday, on the Sunday, you would be wanting to look at the marks that you got. That's how insecure you can be as a youngster in the game. And if you looked at 7 or 8 newspapers and 95% of them give you a good mark, but there was one or two that gave you bad marks, those would be the ones that you would concentrate on. But I think as you get older and you become more experienced, you become your own worst critic. So I didn't need anybody to tell me whether I'd had a bad game. If I come off the pitch, I knew whether I had a good game, a bad game, or an indifferent game. So as you get older, the experience helps you a lot. And like I say, you're your own biggest critic either way, whether you have a good game or whether you're a bad game as well.
Did you think about punditry as you was coming towards the end of your football career, or is it something that fell into your lap?
No, it happened a little bit. Oddly, probably not under the best circumstances. So when I was at Stoke City, we got to semi-finals of the FA Cup, and I scored the winner in the quarterfinals, and everything was going really well. And then I did my cruciate about 2 weeks before the semi-final. So obviously I ended up missing the semi-final and the final. But at that time, obviously the FA Cup is a huge event. And I was interviewed by a couple of different TV companies, radio stations, obviously leading up to the semi-final and then to the final. And it was something that I enjoyed. Didn't really think too much about it after that. And then I got back playing. And when I got back playing, I think I put the majority of my energy that I had left, because I think I was 31, 32 when I did my cruciate. And I put so much of my energy in getting myself back fit that when I actually got back fit, I didn't have much left in my tank. And I soon realised that when I came back that I was coming towards the end of my career. My time had come at Stoke City to move on. And then I moved around a few different clubs on loan. I went to Sheffield United and had, I think, four months towards the end of the season there, and then I stayed for the next season. But then what was happening during pre-season was that we were doing all the pre-season running, you know, so they were long days for footballers. You know, you'd start at 9, probably finish about 4 o'clock, but then I found myself driving down to London for a show at, say, 8 o'clock at night, and then I'd be getting back home at maybe 2 in the morning, having maybe 4 hours sleep, and then going pre-season training, and it didn't bother me, whereas I would never have dreamt of doing that early on in my career. And I was really starting to enjoy it. I got to the point where I didn't enjoy full-time football anymore. I had a season left at Sheffield United still, but I wanted to try and cross things over to see how it would work. So then I went to part-time at Chester, and I was able to do both. So I was able to do the media side of things as well as playing. And then
Who was that that you started with then? Who was the company that's given you the start?
To be honest with you, TalkSport were fantastic with me. They were really good. I was doing shows. I'd do the sports bar on a few occasions, kickoff. Then I was very lucky to work with some very good presenters at the time. Danny Kelly, one of the best around, Mark Saggers, Andy Goldstein, people like that. They were absolutely brilliant to work with Ian Danter, and I learned a lot from them early on. And the one bit of advice I got at the time was that whenever you're doing a show, just imagine you're at the pub with your mates, having a pint, having a talk about football. This wasn't specifically about radio, obviously, minus the swearing and what have you. And just talking about my thoughts, my experiences, how I saw the game, but just try not to contradict yourself. You know, try not to, if you come up with something, then say, I, off my own back, I tended to think that the first answer that I gave wasn't the most important. It was the second one, because more often than not, the second answer that you're going to give is to back up what you said initially. So it's about thinking about what you're going to say and then having a reason and meaning why you are going to say it as well. So it's, otherwise, it's pointless. If someone then comes back and says, well, why are you saying that? And you just come out and say, well, that's the way I think. So football supporters now are probably more educated than ever. You know, with the social media, there's football on television every single day of the week, on the radio as well. So you have to be thorough with the work that you're doing. And it's something that's really enjoyable. I love doing it. I see football from a different angle now, speaking to different managers and what have you. And it's really enjoyable getting to find the knowledge that managers have and the pressures they're under as well.
It's the tactical insight of yours that I really enjoy the most. And obviously that isn't something that you get on TalkSport. So that would have been something that come through probably in your time at MUTV, I imagine, and certainly now with the role that you're doing at Sky. How deep in depth with the analysis do you go? Are you looking at things like expected goals charts, or are you just literally looking at what you see on the pitch, putting yourself in those players' shoes and that manager's shoes, and trying to think tactically what you have done in your career and the sort of things that you've heard managers talking about?
I think on an individual level, you try and give your experiences from when you're playing, but I've learned more tactically than I learned in, 15 years of professional football? Because when you're consumed with a game, when you're actually playing, you're in a bubble. All you're doing is concentrating on the team that you play for, what the manager wants from you, and to a certain extent, maybe looking at the individuals in the opposition team, you know, your opponent, your immediate opponent, whether you're playing centre-back or whether you're playing full-back. But then when you take a step away from that and, you know, you're going to the side that I'm doing now, which is being the media side, you're looking after a lot of different teams, different managers. So you've got to try and see, you know, each team, how they go about things, look at the results that they've had, look at some of the games that they've played previously, the systems that they play in. Every system will have its strengths and every system will have its weaknesses. So it's just looking at that, seeing how goals are being conceded, how they're scoring goals. But it's something that I do find really fascinating and interesting, because as a player, if I had probably the tactical awareness that I have now when I was a player, I think I would have been lost, because there's too much to absorb, there's too much to take in. It's one thing to talk about it, but to have all that, to have that tactical knowledge, but then to be on the football pitch as a player, I don't think it would be that advantageous. I think it's fantastic for managers, because obviously they've got to look after a team, not just individuals. So it's something that I've probably learned more since I was finishing, just in terms of watching specific teams, looking at individual players, reading books. It's a big thing, you know, always having a thirst for knowledge that way, and then speaking to managers and how they see the strengths and weaknesses of their team and how they look to get the better of the opposition as well.
Was there much video analysis about when you was playing?
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a considerable amount, and obviously when Prozone came in, you know, I was still quite young when Prozone came in, there was no hiding place. So, you know, after a game in the dressing room, if there was a goal that had been conceded by yourself and you were getting the finger pointed at you, you needed to make sure that you were spot on. Also, otherwise, come Monday morning, there'd be a video nasty and, you know, you'd be proven completely wrong. So you had to hold your hands up straight away. There was no getting away from it. The amount of cameras that cover a game is in terms of what a football team does, all the different angles, the average positions. So there was no real hiding place. But yeah, video analysis was big, and it was something that leading up to a game, you always wanted to know the player that you were playing against, his strengths, his weaknesses, you know, by watching clips and looking at how he plays the game. And then I knew that on a Saturday, if I'd had a bad game, it wasn't for lack of preparation. It was just because my opponent was better than me. And that happened numerous occasions. But the one thing I would always say is that I didn't have a bad game because my preparation wasn't right. And I could never use that as an excuse because that was never the case. It was just because the individual was better than me and you had to hold your hands up. And I think that as long as you give everything that you've got on the pitch, if your opponent or if the opposing team is better than you, you've just got to accept it for what it is and then learn from it.
I think the speed of which technology is being driven into the game at the moment, obviously you're seeing the sort of stuff Gary Neville does on Monday Night Football is brilliant, and you've had a big play with a massive screen as well that they've got in Sky, which looks awesome. I wish I had one of those. I've done a couple of analysis courses, and a lot of the focus on both of them was about delivering, mostly because they was trying to get people into jobs. I haven't worked in analysis. I've only done the course, and then I do this YouTube channel with it. But the focus seems to be a lot of it on recording the first half to be able to feed information to the manager. Was that something that you had while you were still playing, or was that still to come in the game?
No, it's something that I see more of now, because obviously we're on the gantry.
Yeah.
And when we're on the gantry, you will have the video analysis individual from each football club will usually be up there on the gantry with you, and they'll have everything. They'll have everything in preparation. I think one thing that they'll do, you'll see a lot of time though, there will be somebody in the dugout, and this isn't probably just at halftime, this might be something that's during the game as well. You know, if there's something that's being flagged up, if a fullback is playing too narrow, it might be something that can then be passed down, because obviously when you're up in the gantry, you've got that bird's eye view where sometimes the manager can't see all of that. But at halftime, I used to find that it was individual notes that had been taken by the manager, the assistant manager, and the number of coaches that they had involved. Yes, there could be someone sat in the stand, depending on who that was, and they would come and give their opinion as well. And sometimes you needed a little bit of that, because you can get lost in the game yourself. And I think it's important that players can be in-game managers at times, because there will be times on a football pitch where a manager's trying to get his point of view across, trying to get his messages across, but through the crowd, through the atmosphere, you can't hear it, or you're just so enticed and so involved in the game that you actually can't take it in yourself. So it's something that will be sorted out at halftime a lot. But as we see with managers now, you know, more often than not, most of them have got a writing pad with them. They'll be writing things down, and then they'll go through it at half time. And different managers will do different things. Certain managers will have bullet points where they'll go, right, okay, this is what I want to talk about. Other managers will actually have bullet points up on a board, walk in, allow the players to come in, say nothing, go out of the room. Obviously, the players then see the bullet points on the board, and they'll say, right, okay, this might be a good time for us to discuss about what the manager wants to talk about. Then the manager will come in, have his point of view, and then, listen, you can have an opinion, but it's always the manager that will make the decision about what's going to happen. So players, I think it's important that players do take things on board themselves at times, because although the manager's there giving his side of things, you know, sometimes players have to take it upon themselves to change something in a game when the manager can't get the point across.
It's such a short window of time as well. And people are coming in, you know, players are trying to get a brew, maybe change boots, change shorts, change a shirt. I can't imagine the chaos with a video analysis team trying to show you something that happened at a corner, as well as all the other points that's going on with the manager and everything like that. I'd actually love to just stand in United's dressing room at half-time once and just observe what's going on, because I think it'd be absolutely fascinating to see.
It would be. I think the first thing you want to do with players when they get into a dressing room, you just need to calm them down, because, you know, sometimes their adrenaline's still running for whatever reason from that first half, and they just need them a few minutes to calm down. I'm sure the manager finds himself in that situation as well, where he needs a few minutes as well just to calm down and gather his thoughts. But I think you'll find more often than not, unless there's something crazy happens in the last 4 or 5 minutes of the first half, I would imagine that the manager pretty much knows what he wants to say, and he's going through what he's going to say at halftime to his players, whether he needs to make changes, whether it be substitutions or a tactical change that he needs to make within the game. Is something that he'll probably be processing, I would imagine, before the end of the first half. But being in the dressing room is great, because you're going to come in and there'll be certain times when individuals will be having conversations because they want to create a 2v1 situation attacking, or one player's finding himself isolated 2 against 1. So there'll be them conversations, but then everybody comes together, and that's when the manager has his say. And, you know, it's sometimes better to take a step back from manager's point of view, which a lot of them do. They'll have 3 or 4 minutes, allow you to do whatever you're doing, say whatever you're saying, get your drink, and then they'll come in. Then they'll get their point across, and then it's up to you then to take it out there on the pitch in the second half.
Madness. I can imagine the chaos at half-time sometimes, especially if there's major tactical changes to be made and everything like that. I mean, it's a hell of a lot of information to cram in. But I'm sure that they're also working on this, that there's a contingency, or, you know, from Thursday and Friday. Look, if this is happening, we're going to do this. But anyway, that's enough on that. Let's talk about this year's Premier League season, because it's absolutely wild, isn't it? for different reasons, let's be honest with ourselves. Big shout out to the likes of Burnley and teams like that that are just absolutely flying up there. Big Sam's come in and absolutely transformed Everton. I wasn't even certain that was possible, but they're flying up there now. Even David Moyes has turned West Ham around, but I guess we're going to have to talk about what's going on at the top. This comes out Monday morning, so you guys are watching this Monday morning right now, but last night, just now for us really, we just watched Liverpool absolutely tear City to pieces, and then as it went to 4-1, I texted one of the lads and said, 4-all incoming. And then the way it ended, I thought, it would have been the most Liverpool way to do it, wouldn't it? To absolutely expose the weaknesses in this City team's defence and then capitulate. What does this mean for the title, this result of City?
It means that Manchester City are beatable, but I don't think it's going to change too much. What will be interesting is to see the reaction from Manchester City. Obviously, the first defeat in the Premier League this season, how they react to that. People say there is a way to beat Manchester City. Liverpool have shown that today, but there's not many teams that possess the pace and power that Liverpool do. Yeah. And I thought Liverpool did it really well against Tottenham a few months ago, because I always believe you're one of the teams near the top of the Premier League. You're going to have more possession. So I believe the more possession you have, the more open to the counter-attack you are. So we've seen it with Manchester United at times. They'll play the back four. One full-back will go and Matic will sit. If both the full-backs go at the same time, you'll have Matic and Herrera probably sitting. So you're always defending with a four. We've seen it with Tottenham. If they play with a back three, you've got the back three and a defensive midfielder. If they don't, it'll be a back four. One of the full-backs may sit a little bit deep and they've got the one defensive midfielder. We see with Chelsea, the three and the one. But Liverpool, for such a long time, always had the two centre-backs and the one defensive midfielder. Both full-backs would go forward. And I always believe that if you're a team that's dominating a game, you've got to be able to cover the width of the pitch. So in order to do that, I think you've always got to have four players back behind the ball. Now, after the Tottenham game, Liverpool, did they change that? We've seen them play 4-2-3-1. OK, they played 4-3-3 today. Mm-hmm. But they have played 4-2-3-1 with two sitting midfielders. But what they're doing now, that 4-3-3, it's one player that has the license to go box to box. Obviously, it was Oxlade-Chamberlain today, and you saw Wijnaldum and Chan, they were the two sitters. And I think that has helped them no end. Okay, yes, they conceded three goals, but that's nothing major against Manchester City, is it? So
only four shots, though, which highlights their weakness with the goalkeeper. Only four shots on target.
Yeah.
Three goals conceded.
Well, I think the problem is that if you are one of the top teams that are going to be challenging for the Premier League title, it's okay, you want to have a top goalkeeper, but if you haven't got that top goalkeeper, it's not about changing them. Mm. You don't see Chelsea chopping and changing the keeper. You don't see Manchester United doing it. Manchester City doing it. You don't see that. There needs to be consistency, because the biggest thing in my mind is that within a back four or back three and a goalkeeper, that's the area that needs to be the most consistent. Your forward three, your forward two, your forward line, whatever it may be, you can change that as much as you want, because there doesn't have to be a massive understanding between them, because a lot of them possess individual brilliance. So therefore, you know, they do things off the cuff. You cannot do that with a defensive unit. So in an ideal world, you have a goalkeeper that's consistently playing, two centre-backs as well, because the understanding between the two centre-backs and the goalkeeper, in my mind, is the most important understanding on a football pitch, knowing the strengths and weaknesses of each other. And that's something that you're not going to get when a goalkeeper is constantly in and out of the team. So, yeah, I would imagine from Klopp's point of view, he's probably looking at it and thinking, right, OK, I've got to go out and get a top goalkeeper. They brought Van Dijk, and I don't care what anybody says about the money. He didn't choose that transfer fee. Money's gone crazy now. I think he's very relaxed about it, and I think he'll go on to be a top player for Liverpool. But the way Liverpool went about it today, I think you've got to have the two presses. You've got to have that one press to stop them playing out from the back. But then the players that are doing that first press, they've then got to have the pace to get back behind the ball. So what Liverpool did, Liverpool played with a defensive six. So they had the back four and the two defensive midfielders that we've previously spoken about. The full-backs were adventurous, but not overly adventurous. And they allowed Oxlade-Chamberlain, Salah, Mane, and Firmino to go and get on with it. So he said, right, defend with a six, attack with a four. And it was brilliant. The front three, so interchangeable. Oxlade-Chamberlain scored the first goal, which was fantastic. But they always made sure that they were defensively sound. And they had enough pace in the team to make sure that when Manchester City got into Liverpool's half, everybody barring Firmino was near enough back behind the ball. So they had two presses, but they were able to break really quickly. And people have said to me, and it's one thing that really frustrates me. I did a piece on it last week. Everyone's going on about all the possession. Possession, you know, teams just sitting back, just allowing Manchester City to do exactly what they want to do. It's as though they're giving up the game. Well, Newcastle, who everybody said, well, Newcastle just give up the game. They had 2% less possession than Crystal Palace. Liverpool only had 35% today, or 36% at the most. But the difference is it's not about possession, it's what you do with it. So what Newcastle found themselves was with an isolated centre-forward with not enough pace to get up and support him. Whereas you look at Crystal Palace, like I say, 2% more than Newcastle. But when the ball went up to Benteke, you had players like Townsend, Zaha, able to make the ground up quickly and support the front man. Very similar with Liverpool. So it's not about the lack of possession, it's what you do with it. Because you've got to allow City onto you to a certain extent to create that space in behind. Fernandinho is a phenomenal player. So I don't think you're going to get that much space in between the two centre-backs and the defensive midfielder. So at times it's got to come from the width. And we see how attack-minded Manchester City's full-backs are, in particular Walker, who's one of the best in Europe. So I don't buy into all this possession things, that the less possession you have, and it means that you're not trying to win the game, you're just hoping to get away from the game without embarrassment. I disagree with it. It's what you do with it when you've got the ball.
In that way, United cocked up, though, because I also agree with you that I think that in a team that's going to want possession and they hold it where they hold it, with such a high defensive line, for me, the way to attack this City team for United was to use the pace that we've got in the likes of Martial and Rashford, Lingard, and get in behind those fullbacks, because those fullbacks are getting forward. That I always thought that's where the most space is on the pitch, and we can get into those channels. I thought the problem that United had, not having Pogba and not having a Mkhitaryan that was on form, is we had nobody to take it from the defence and move it up through those thirds to give it to those players to actually cause City any damage.
I think the biggest problem was that everybody was saying in that game that Man United played a lot of long balls. You know, there'll be a lot of teams that will play long balls against Manchester City because you have two ways of beating the press. You either go over it or you go through it. And it can be very difficult to go through it because it's very rarely highlighted that Manchester City are great on the ball, but the way they win the ball back, the way they press when they lose it, is that more often than not, the player that's picking up the ball for the opposition, they've got about 3 seconds before they've got to give the ball or she's in trouble. Now, everyone says, well, try and play through Manchester City. Good luck in doing that. Unless you're Barcelona or unless you've got a David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne in that team, you ain't going to be able to play through them. It's too difficult. Manchester United's biggest problem against Manchester City, I thought, was that not the fact that they were playing long balls to try and go over the top. It was a simple fact that the long balls were straight down the middle. So where we talk about the fact that Manchester City's full-backs, Walker more so than Delph, because we know that Delph goes into that central midfield area, the space is down the sides of the pitch. And the amount of times that the ball was just played into Lukaku or play forward towards Lukaku, but he had two centre-backs behind him. He had Fernandinho on his toes. It was near enough impossible for him. It was very rare that he was able to isolate a centre-back down the centre.
There was also poor quality balls, wasn't there? It wasn't good balls.
No, it wasn't good balls, but that's what I'm saying about Manchester City. They don't allow you to do that. They're unbelievable, and they deserve great credit. Okay, they've been beaten today, but the way they've gone about things this season has been phenomenal. You know, we know that all teams have tried to stop them, but you know, I did the recent Watford game. I did the Swansea game. Against Watford, they pushed Sterling and Sané really wide. So the fullbacks had a problem. Did they go with Sterling and Sané? Because if they did, there was a huge gap between the centre-backs and the fullbacks, and De Bruyne and David Silva took full advantage of that. It was unbelievable to watch. And then against Swansea away, where Swansea did the same thing, played 4-5-1, kept the midfield and the defence together. Danilo and Delph, who were playing the two fullbacks. When City went forward, Danilo and Delph went into central midfield area. So you ended up with a midfield three of Danilo, Fernandinho and Delph. Swansea midfield was like, we can't be doing with this. So they went and out to them three, well, two fullbacks and one central midfielder that were taking up the central midfield. All of a sudden, the gaps then appeared between the midfield and defence, and that's where De Bruyne, David Silva, Sterling, Bernardo Silva took full advantage. So as much as teams are saying, right, we've got to come up with a plan against Manchester City, they seem to have, apart from today, they've had answers all season. I think you've got to, as much as it can hurt from Manchester United fans' point of view, you have to appreciate and respect them. And the simple fact of, you know, Guardiola, everyone goes on about, it's one thing that does frustrate me when people go on about, oh, well, he spent all this money. Well, let's look at his top players. Who have been the best players this season? He didn't sign any of them. So that tells me that he's an unbelievable coach because he's improved these players no end. You know, Sterling, De Bruyne, David Silva, Aguero, Otamendi, you could argue,
Fernandinho. But these aren't no-mark players coming from nowhere. These are players signed for top dollar that have been at the top of the game for a long time. I got to admit that you've got to give him credit for putting them together and making the product that he's made with them. But, like, you know, Sterling went for 50 million for a reason. You know, it wasn't because he was, you know, clapped out and looking at lower league.
Yeah, but I think he's taken him to another level to have scored far more goals this season than he has.
Oh, God, yeah, his scoring is ridiculous.
So, give him credit. And I would also say as well, with Guardiola, the problem that United have at times is that before Mourinho, it was different managers that wanted different things from the team. Okay, so you had Sir Alex Ferguson, the greatest manager of all time. Then you have David Moyes, who wants one particular brand of football. Van Gaal then wants a different brand of football. And then Mourinho comes in and he wants a different brand again. Whereas I think if you look at Guardiola, he inherited a group of players that had been known for possession-based football, but been known for playing that good football, whether it be through Pellegrino and various other managers. So therefore, the transition was probably easier for the players under Guardiola than it was for Mourinho, because he already had a number of players that were suited to the way that Guardiola wanted to play. Whereas with Manchester United, because they'd had a few managers in such a short space of time, different managers had tried to stamp their authority on Manchester United's team, but playing in different ways. So that's what's made it more difficult for Mourinho. And I just think at the moment that Mourinho gets flak, Manchester United get flak, but you have to look at the statistics behind it, because at the end of the day, there's only Manchester United and Manchester City that have more points than this time last season. The rest of them have got less points. So the one argument that Manchester United support would be saying, and rightly so, is, well, hang on a second. Manchester United have got, I think they've scored 12 more goals this season, conceded 5 less, and got 6 points more. Yet they're getting stick, yet you've got Chelsea are 9 points worse off.
Champions.
Arsenal are 8 points worse off. Spurs are 3 points worse off. And Liverpool are still 1 point worse off. But Manchester United are the ones that get it. And sometimes you just have to... You just have to deal with it as supporters. And Manchester United is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, football club in the world. And I'm sure that they just take that on board. I think the one thing that hasn't helped is that it's the City rivals.
Yeah,
that are doing
it's
it.
City going on an absolute tear, breaking records. It's left everyone. I mean, the whole conversation that we're having with people is everyone looking over at Stockport and just going, look what's going on over there, rather than look at us. Well, just look at us. Like, we've got a manager, and I'm hoping in the next couple of days we're going to sign a player that's going to help us potentially get further in the Champions League.
Mm-hmm.
Treble's still on, Danny. We can still do this.
Yeah.
Do you know what actually hurts, though, is the 6 points that we dropped in December. Winnable games from winnable positions pretty much as well, where we capitulated. And we would be talking here now about United turn Stoke over at home tomorrow, 6 points. Yeah. 6 points is almost in your hands, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, especially when you've still got to go and play them. And I think that's what's going to hurt us. Forget about the Huddersfield game. It happens. Forget about the City game at home. Forget about the Liverpool game. Just those three would have made such a massive difference. And the pressure now would really be on. City are still that far ahead that the pressure's not really going to be on. Do you think United are going to finish comfortably inside the top four?
Yes. Yeah. 100%. I think that Manchester United's progression is not being highlighted because of the simple fact of what we just said about what Manchester City are doing. Arsenal are going to find themselves in a quandary, as in terms of what do they do? Do they prioritise Europa League or do they prioritise getting into top four?
I put a bet on today. I did a request
a
bet on Sky.
And
I asked for the odds for Burnley to finish above Arsenal this season, especially if you lose Sanchez. 50-1 they've given us.
50-1?
I'm just wondering what I can sell, because that needs to be as... I need to go big on that, I think.
It would be... Don't get me wrong, I think even if Sanchez and Ozil both got, I think it would be a surprise, 100%. Yeah.
Going deep in Europa without Sanchez and Ozil?
Yeah, I think so, because Burnley, they've had a phenomenal season, and Guardiola's, I think he's won all but one Premier League managers of the month so far. Sean Dyche is my manager of the year already. What he's done is the away performances, the amount of points they're getting from that, the way that, listen, let's not forget, he lost Keane.
Yeah,
he lost Gray.
They lost some right players. I thought they would
Heaton.
Be... Heaton. I was looking at relegation. I was
wrong. They've been absolutely fantastic. But I don't know. No, I just, personally, I can't see them going finishing above Arsenal. Arsenal find themselves in a predicament once again. They're creating all their own problems. You know, it's the amount of times they sell players to their domestic rivals if I was an Arsenal supporter, it would frustrate the life out of me, because you're actually making yourself weaker while strengthening your domestic rival. If you sell to Real Madrid, if you sell to Barcelona, listen, they're the ultimate. You know, we've seen it. We've seen it with the likes of Suarez. We've seen it with Ronaldo. You've seen it with a Gareth Bale. It's very difficult. You've seen it with Coutinho recently. That's very difficult. Okay, you don't lose your best players, but it's more acceptable. But if you're losing your best players for a knockdown price
continually,
yeah, continually, that would really be a frustrating thing. And what makes life even more difficult for Arsenal then is that if you see, so if we look at Arsenal, Sanchez and Ozil, you've got to say that they're two best players. They could potentially be going for a free in the summer, or you lose Sanchez now for a real cut-down price. So what does that say to any prospective players that Arsenal are trying to sign? Well, you don't keep hold of your best players.
It could also be, if you wanted to look a bit dark, it could also be a way that someone at Arsenal could use to recruit. Come and play for us, have a good season, we'll definitely sell you on someone.
What, are you saying they're a feeder club?
Yeah. Well, I think when you sign for Arsenal, they give you an A to Z of Manchester, I think. Just keep that in your pocket.
But it must be so frustrating, because you take a step back and then from an Arsenal supporter's point of view, when on their day, they're a match for anybody in the Premier League. Yeah. But you cannot consistently sell or lose your better players. At some point, you've got to say, right, we're going to build, because I've seen over the years, I've seen some phenomenal Arsenal teams. And, you know, to let their best players go, the biggest one was they basically gave the Premier League trophy to Man United when they gave him Robin van Persie for what it turns out to be unbelievable price.
All the way back to Ashley Cole and Fabregas, and they've just continually allowed players at their peak. Because it's one thing letting players go a little bit past the peak. It doesn't really happen at United. You see a lot of people finish their career here, maybe even cling on a little bit too long if you want to get technical. But you never see people really leaving United at the peak, ever. You know, arguably Beckham, Ronaldo.
I think if you look at Manchester United over the years, especially the successful years, when you left Manchester United, more often than not, you were only going one way. Mm. Now,
even when Rude left to go Real Madrid, he didn't do well there.
No. And Manchester United, obviously, you know, they've had an unprecedented amount of success over the last 15, 20 years under Sir Alex Ferguson when he was there. But the amount of players that have probably left Arsenal and then gone to other clubs and won Premier League trophies, that's the problem. That's the problem. And therefore, it's very difficult then it becomes more difficult to sell the football club to a player, because it's a massive football club. But when you are consistently losing your best players to domestic rivals, at some point, a player's going to go, well, I'm not going to come there, because we're losing our best players, and we're actually weakening your own position while strengthening a team that's your direct rival in the Premier League.
If they had a Daniel Levy, can you imagine how different it would be? He'd have got top dollar for him, or he'd have shipped him off abroad, getting top dollar for him.
Well, everybody turns around and says, well, it's not Arsenal's fault. You know, if a player now wants to see the last 6 months of his contract, well, should have sold him when they have 2 years left.
Yeah.
The minute you go and a player has less than 2 years left on his contract, you either give him a new one or you sell them. It's as simple as that, because, you know, you can't... Listen, when I was playing, they could let me go down to my last 3 weeks and offer me a contract. It was all right. But your top players, you cannot allow them to go into the last year and a half, 2 years of the contract, because it's the amount of other teams that are going to come around and say, listen, we'll get you a cut price, or just wait and we'll come and get you in a free. So the problems that we're seeing now with Sanchez and obviously Ozil as well, these aren't immediate problems. These were problems a year and a half ago when they were going into the last 2 years of the contract.
Absolutely. Right, you spoke about 4-4-2 as still being the perfect system that you'd like to see. Obviously, Leicester have had success with it in the Premier League recently. You've seen the likes of Atletico Madrid employ it quite well. There are teams that are finding a little bit of success. United have tried it once this season. We tried Zlatan and Lukaku up front.
Mm.
And I think it didn't really work, because I don't think Zlatan's working at the moment. I think he's a long way from being what he was last season. Do you still think 4-4-2 has got a place at the very top level? Not just in scrappy teams like Leicester that are hitting people on the counter, but in a team that dominates possession and is looking to do that every game. Do you think someone like United could do that?
Yeah, I personally think so. The one thing that I think you would probably err on the side of caution and say that it's more difficult to do now is that we don't see many natural wingers.
That was my next point, actually, to talk about the wingers, because it's a massive part of it.
Yeah, I go back to me growing up, supporting Manchester United, used to seeing Lee Sharp, Ryan Giggs, Kanchelskis. Ronaldo was originally a winger. Then you had Nani. But there was great ones all over the Premier League. You know, you had Overmars, you had Duff, you had Robin, Perez. The list goes on.
Gamps, Morden, Pedersen.
You had loads. You had loads, but it was every week you would be facing a winger, and it was like, wow, he's got pace, he's got skill, and he's got trickery. So that's one of the problems why 4-4-2 becomes more difficult to work, because let's not forget, towards the end of 4-4-2 probably being seen as one of the main tactical systems, you were playing with inverted wingers, so a lot of the players playing in the wide areas were actually central midfielders that were tucked inside. But I just think that if you have natural wingers, I still think it is a no-brainer. It enables you to get two centre forwards in the team. What you've got to have, though, one of your centre forwards has to be selfless. He has to be a player that can do that defensive side of things, because we know defensive midfielders are key now. So therefore, he has to have the bit about him where he can actually drop off and say, right, okay, I know I'm doing my centre forward work, but I've got to stop him getting on the ball. We talk about wide areas now, the amounts of goals we used to see from crosses, we don't see as many goals from crosses now. You can have 2v1s down the side, because really the only true width that you get, whether you play 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3 or even 3-4-3-3-5-2, it comes from one player. So it enables you to get 2v1 there, enables you to be compact in midfield. So yeah, I do believe that 4-4-2 is still a great system, but it's whether there's enough of that type of player left now to actually bring it out like it used to be. There's not a Ryan Giggs anymore. There's very few of them. He was one of the best. I'm not talking about with his quality. I'm talking about there's not many natural wingers yet.
Could you name anybody that has the sort of style of Beckham where they're just a crossing machine with
brilliant.
Limited pace, really. Let's be honest with ourselves.
But what he had, because he had the movement around him, because you had Gary Neville constantly going beyond him or even backing him up, by the time Beckham had one touch, if you weren't there within 3 seconds, he was just whipping the ball in and it was game over. So yes, different wingers, but like you say, you know, he was still a winger, but because there's not many of them left now that actually want to get the so-called chalk on the boots type thing, most of them want to come inside now. So you have a look at it, most players that start wide, they're inverted wingers. Prime example being Liverpool. You know, you've got Salah and you've got Mane. You know, both of them, they love to drive inside with the ball, go and join in with the
everyone
individual
at United
forward.
Now, including Sanchez, that's about to come. If he plays him on the left, if he plays him on the right, I'm hoping he plays him on the right, to be honest, to give us some balance there. But all of those are inverted on the left.
They are, but as long as you've got two attacking fullbacks, which, you know, I'm delighted for Luke Shaw. I think it's brilliant. You know, he could go on to be a really important player for Manchester United. We know that he loves to get forward. We know that whoever plays in front of him, you know, whether it's Lingard, drifts into that 10 role. Rashford wants to drive inside. Martial wants to drive inside. You know, Pogba, he needs to have the freedom as well. But, you know, Luke Shaw hopefully can do on the left-hand side what Valencia's been doing on the right-hand side. Because
I wish Valencia would just cross it a bit more. Just have a bit more firing him in. Because he was excellent as as an attacking winger when we signed him. He had the most basic trick that no one could get a grip of. He'd stand the defender up one ear, knock it with the outside of his foot and bang across. And he got bucket loads of assists doing it. And he's just gone from his game.
I still think he's been absolutely brilliant. Consistent-wise over the last couple of years, I think he's been fantastic. And him and Juan Mata, they've got a really good partnership, because you know that Juan Mata likes to drift inside as well. So I think what you're finding now is within whatever system you're playing, it's all about bringing the best out in individuals, but sometimes it might be something that somebody else does. So we saw Manchester United, Everton played 4-3-3. Pogba was absolutely outstanding. But he had that license to do that because you had Matic and Herrera that were sitting more. He also had the space to go into, because although Lingard was starting out on the left-hand side, he would drift into that 10 role, so that created the space for him to go into.
It's just movement, though, isn't it? It's movement, which is what we didn't have under Van Gaal. And
you still
see now and then under the Mourinho regime that there's a lack of movement sometimes in the final third. And you just see the players standing there looking at the ball carrier, and you're like, honestly, really, lads, move. Like, this is under 10 stuff.
That's why I think that Lingard is in sensational form. He's been a late developer. There's been no doubt about it. But, you know,
that's what he brings.
You've got to be waxing lyrical about him at the minute, because I don't just see him as quick. I think he's an intelligent player. I think the way that he does things. I think the fact that him and Pogba grew up together, won the Youth Cup together, I think there's a really good understanding between them two. And I think Pogba is a catalyst for it all. Because as we said previously, is that 95% of the games that Manchester United play, you're going to be playing against a defensive team that's going to play very deep. And what Pogba does, he gets past the opposition midfield. So if he gets past the opposition midfield, all of a sudden that back four has to become disjointed. So one of the centre-backs has to come out. If the centre-back doesn't come out and the full-back comes out, then you've got Luke Shaw. You've got Lingard that may have kept his width waiting out there. But what happens more often than not, because of the way that Pogba's running into, he commits a centre-back. Then all of a sudden, the gap between the centre-back and the far full-back is huge, and that's where Lukaku takes advantage of it. So I just think that Pogba needs to have that constant licence to be able to go forward. That's when he was best at Juventus.
He doesn't get that when he's played on the same line. In the 4-2-3-1, when he's played, this will be off camera for everyone else, but when he's played back here, it's off camera for you actually, when he's played in the six and he's on that line, he's starting 20, 30 metres further backwards. That's when you see him start to do that Pirlo and Scholesy ball over the top, don't you? As opposed to those short, quick one-touch balls in and around the D, which is what actually opens defences for us.
Yeah, I wouldn't want him to, there's got to be a happy medium, because you talk about him starting too deep there, but I think there's also a point where he could start too high.
Yeah, I don't like him as a 10. He's an 8. It's got to be an 8.
Pogba, when he picks up that ball, I think unless you are actually in a foot race with him, I don't think you appreciate how quick he is. Mm. He's got that style about him that Yaya Toure had when he was at his prime. You would see him and then you'd play against him and you'd be like, oh, he's not that quick. He was a Rolls Royce. It just looked as though he was sauntering, just as though he was jogging. But he would be what you thought was jogging, and you'd be sprinting and he'd still leave you behind. And that's what Pogba does. He's got that style that it's like, wow, he's quick, but it doesn't look as though he's actually moving. He's gliding across the pitch. So I think Pogba's a better player when he gets that ball and drives the ball. Midfielders cannot live with him. So what he does, it's the knock-on effect. Then he drives the ball, gets beyond the opposition midfield. All of a sudden, you're onto the opposition back four. That's when they get taken out of shape. So I think if you have Herrera and Matic to a certain extent playing alongside Pogba, that gives Pogba the license to start a little bit higher up and takes away the defensive responsibilities away from him. And I think that's when he's at his best, because on his day, he is one of the best midfielders in world football at what he does. And the more that Manchester United can get him on the ball, the more that Manchester United can play to his strengths, the better it's got to be. You spend that amount of money on a player, you play to his strengths and you build a team around him.
Do you think there's something in the conversion rates of our strikers? When you look at last season, two seasons ago, Zlatan's last season in France, I think he was around about the 27% conversion, 50-odd goals, comes to United, was our leading scorer, but his conversion rate was 12%. Yeah. Last season, Lukaku was, I think, 0.1% under Kane for conversion rate, scored a right load of goals for Everton, comes to United, his conversion rate this season has been 12%. Is that something about where United are putting the balls in for the forward, do you think? Because I don't think there's... I think there's too much of a coincidence that both those strikers, totally different style of play, have managed to come up with the same sort of conversion rate. Do you think it's United more than them?
It's a difficult one, because it all depends on the opportunities that they're getting. You know, what's considered the conversion rate? Is it a tap-in that's been put wide? Is it an opportunity? It's a difficult one to tell. The one thing I would say about Lukaku is that he was a victim of his own early success at Manchester United. So, you know, we've seen some top centre-forwards over the years come to Manchester United, go on to have phenomenal careers at Manchester United, but it's taken him a little bit to hit the ground running. Lukaku come in, hit the ground running. All of a sudden, he has that patch where he's not scoring for a bit. There's question marks over him then. Whereas if he didn't hit the ground running like he did and didn't have that great a start, nobody would be saying that much at the minute. He's still, what, is he maybe third or fourth or not far off that, as in terms of top goal scorers?
I think he's got 16 goals already, which in... first week of January is class.
Exactly. So that's where that's when we spoke about it previously, about trying to look at it, take a step back and look at it for what it is, instead of going, oh, he's missing chance after chance, have a look at it and go, well, he's in the right place. Mm. He's scored the amount of goals that he's scored. He's getting opportunities. So he's going to put the ball into the back of the net. You are going to get opportunities from playing for Manchester United. My concern would be, is if he wasn't getting opportunities. Because then you'd be like, wow, he's not getting many chances. If he gets two chances in the game, he's got to score one of the goals, but he's getting a lot of chances. So that tells me that he's getting in the right place. It tells me that his teammates are understanding what he wants and he will go on goal-scoring runs. I just think it's because he started so well. The amount of goals he scored at the start of the season. Let's not forget Mkhitaryan as well. He was
game unbelievable. Game after game.
It was. And more often than not, being assisted by Mkhitaryan.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take too much from it. I just think it's an incredible start that he's had. And it's been compared now to that. He came in, it was like, wow, look at Lukaku. He's been brilliant. For me, he's a fantastic sign. Will go on to be a fantastic sign. And I think, let's not forget, he's not the finished article yet.
No.
He's nowhere near his peak. And Manchester United is still a team in, not transition, but progression. I think that Mourinho still would like to stamp more of his authority onto the team. It is a rebuilding process to a certain extent, but they're going in the right direction. And I really do believe that if Manchester City hadn't set the pace that they'd set and been breaking all records, everybody would be talking about what a season Manchester United have had, because they've had a great season. And as long, from a United supporter's point of view, as long as you're seeing progression every season in terms of where you're finishing in the league, the goals that you're scoring, the players you're bringing in, for me, that's I don't see it as an issue whatsoever. And they are, there's progression at that football club without a question.
But I think Lukaku is a progression and an evolution of what Zlatan offered as well, because Zlatan scored all the goals last season, but Martial was the closest to him on 11. Where if you look at the goals that have been spread around the team this year, and I think a lot of that is down to Lukaku's movement, you see a lot of the goals people are scoring. If you look where Lukaku was, he's carried a defender out of the way, or two defenders out of the way, and made space for somebody else with his run, which I think is really difficult, especially when you're looking at black and white stats, to really quantify how he did that, or what he did, or what he's bringing to the team. But I think his contribution has been massive.
I compare it to Son at Tottenham. As in, not Son compared to Lukaku, but if you look at Harry Kane, Dele Alli, Christian Eriksen, they are the three main men for Tottenham. You know, any team that comes out that goes, right, we've got to stop them. We have to stop these three players. Because then if we stop these three players, then our life becomes a lot easier. But Son has now taken on that mantle. He's gone, right, okay, you're going to stop them three. Then I'll take advantage. He's got 11 goals in all competitions this season. So Lukaku, first thing you're doing as a defender or a defensive midfielder, you're thinking, right, we've got to stop Lukaku. Then we've got to stop Pogba. And we're getting to the point now where we've got to stop Lingard. So there's always going to be a player. Exactly. So there's always going to be that, possibly that one player that you're stopping. I think Lingard, he's done unbelievably well. I think he's probably been underestimated by a lot of opposition teams. But teams are going to stop underestimating him soon, because it's not a fluke what he's doing. So I always believe that when you have two or three top players that are, I'm not saying the top players at the football club, but on their game at that time, that's when it's up to the other players that aren't considered the three most dangerous players in the team to take advantage of it. Because the amount of times that you've seen Manchester United over the years, you've seen Manchester City over the years, Liverpool over the years, they may have this one player or these two players, and all of a sudden there's two players marking that individual. Well, if there's two players marking that individual, another player is free. So as much as people say, well, Lukaku, he's having a little bit of a dry spell, like you just said, let's have a look where he is when that ball's been put to the back of there. Oh, I'm going to say, Lingard's just scored, Martial's just scored, Rashford's just scored, Lukaku's got two men on him. Ah, the reason they've had the space to score is because Lukaku's taken two players out of the way. So there's all different ways of looking at it. You know, it's, and that's what you've got to do. Listen, I know a centre forward is judged on the goals that he scores. And if he's just on the goals that he scored, then he's had a good season as well. But it's what he does off the ball as well. And I think that it's a collective rather than an individual type of thing. Yes, you'll have individual brilliance and players will do certain things. You only have to look at Messi now. He's changed his role within the game. He's taking the old Xavi role, dropping a little bit deeper, creating space for other players. He's still a phenomenal player. It's just that you have to look at the movement and what they're doing on the pitch and why are they doing it. And if you look at it and think it's creating opportunities for others, then he's still doing his job. Okay, he probably wants to keep scoring, but I have no worries about Lukaku whatsoever. Anybody that does is just somebody that wants to say, a waste of money. That's all you hear. Okay, well, if people want to say he's a waste of money, why? Why is he wasting money? Because he's one of the top goal scorers in the Premier League, because he's playing for one of the top clubs and at the ground running. When you've got to come up with something, don't just label that. This time last year, everybody was saying Pogba's transfer fee was extortionate. Now it's been seen as an absolute bargain. It's the way football is.
What do you think... I'll phrase this right so it don't get clipped up by everybody, but I think it looks as if Alexis Sanchez could well be on his way to Manchester United, it seems. If that's the case, what does he bring to Manchester United, and does he change our outlook for the rest of the season?
He brings a versatility. to the football club. I think when Guardiola had him at Barcelona, that was one of the things that he said. He's versatile. He can play as a number nine. He can be anywhere within that front three, even the front man. Mm-hmm. We saw at times at Arsenal he played as the one up front in a 4-2-3-1. We've seen him play on the left. We've seen him play as a 10. So he's got all them attributes. He's got all the attributes that he needs to be successful at a top football club. I think he's got the mentality as well. We've seen people saying, oh, look, him throwing a strop on the pitch and things like that. That's because he wants to win every game. He never stops running. And if Manchester United can get him, I think it'll be an absolutely phenomenal signing. As in terms of what does it do for the rest of the season, I think it gives everybody a lift to do with Manchester United. I think players within the football club, I think supporters. I think the fact that he's chosen Manchester United over a number of other football clubs would give that as well. And he does bring something different as in terms of his low centre of gravity as well. We've seen the way that he can make things happen out of nothing. You know, he gets the ball in an area where he shouldn't be able to get out of, but because of his stature, because of his build, you know, he may be the man that when teams are sitting really deep, he can just unlock that with his movement, with his little bit of genius as well. So it'll be interesting to see if it happens. If it happens, I think it'll be absolute brilliant signing. I think he'll strengthen Manchester United's squad. It will be interesting to see where he fits in the team. Mm. What Mourinho sees as his ideal system. We know that he's played 4-2-3-1 for a lot of the recent time. I think the last time he played 4-3-3 consistently was at Real Madrid. You know, so that'll be interesting. I think 4-3-3 is the way forward for Manchester United.
I'm just going to ask you that, actually. I think 4-3-3 is our best formation. I think the lack of having somebody in that place where a number 10 is where Pogba drives through.
And
The other number 8 alongside him does a little bit more of that donkey work and occasionally covers. And it gives Matic the reign to cover both sides of the pitch, which I think he does excellently well. And I think it just gives that... I often see around the D, it's just very congested. When you've got a number 10, he's in there and he's almost just standing there because he's like, I'm a number 10, I guess I'm supposed to stand on the edge of the area. And I think that it's easier for the usually two defensive midfielders to just sit back and constrict his space. But I think when you've got two number 8s, because let's face it, they're not in the centre of the pitch for Manchester United, are they? They're on the edge of the box. I think it gives us more options when, even though you think, oh, 4-2-3-1's got more attacking players than 4-3-3. I actually think you end up with more attacking players playing 4-3-3.
I think in a 4-3-3 as well, what you can do, 4-3-3 can be defensive or it can be attack-minded. It's all what you do with them three midfielders. If there was a particular game you're saying, right,
you used to play at Stoke with Pulis, didn't you? 4-3-3?
We would. Well, no, a lot of the times it would be a 4-4-2 or not necessarily a 4-3-3, but the thing I would say about 4-3-3 is that it can be as attacking as you want or as defensive as you want. All you have to do, them three midfielders, you either play with two sitters or one sitter. Mm. If you want to play with one sitter, then you can have a player either side of Matic, Pogba and another. My only thing when I do look at that is that Pogba is the only player in Manchester United's team that can do what he can do. I think Matic can do it to a certain extent. You know, power pass players. I think we've seen that. We've even seen it at certain times with Manchester United. But he's needed to be that defensive player. But there's not someone... Listen, Pogba's a phenomenal player. I don't mean there's not someone in that can do exactly what Pogba can do as good as him. I'm on about someone that has the attributes of Pogba on the other side of Matic who can be that box-to-box player. So you can have that in that system or you can have two sitters. We've seen with Herrera and Matic at times, if they want to sit, they form a box then. It means the two full-backs, we talk about it. You know, I always believe that the bigger teams need to have a defensive force. So if you've got your two centre-backs and, say, Matic and Herrera, the recovery runs from the two full-backs can be into central midfield and then Matic and Herrera can actually go and cover the wide area. So you've always got a four covering the width of the pitch. I think that they have the full-backs now to play 4-3-3 if you're going to play with two sitters because they're the ones that can give you the width in Valencia. I think Young does it extremely well as well. You've got Luke Shaw that can do it. So you've got fullbacks that can do that, that can go and give you the width. You've got a Lingard or a Rashford or a Martial on that left-hand side that get the ball and they want to drive inside. Now, because they want to drive inside, that leaves a gaping hole. That leaves a gaping hole for Pogba to get into. Because if I'm a fullback and I'm thinking to myself, right, first of all, I'm hoping that my winger's tracking United's left-back Luke Shaw. Then as a fullback, my biggest concern is Rashford, Lingard, Martial. They get the ball or they're making a run inside. What do I do? If I leave them, I'm in big trouble. So I've got to go with them. all of a sudden there's a space that Pogba gets into. So it's knowing that if you're going to play inverted wingers like Manchester United are doing most of the time, the space that's being created by them inverted wingers going and joining in with Lukaku, who's going to run into it? On the left-hand side, it's perfect for Pogba. Mm-hmm. And then I also think because Lukaku stretches the game, inevitably what happens is the opposition midfield get frustrated and the opposition midfield defence starts going further and further apart. That's where Pogba can get into as well. That's where Lingard can get into coming off the left-hand side. So it's all about having the systems, but also having them partnerships and the domino effect within that system. And that's what I think Manchester United are getting. We have Valencia and Juan Mata on the right-hand side, the way they work. You start to see Pogba now and Lingard, the way they work together. Luke Shaw. Imagine them three on the left-hand side.
I've been doing all over Christmas.
What'd you do? I think as an opposition player, you'd go and run into the tunnel and just hope nothing happens. It's so difficult. And that's what happens then, because you're damned, I think as a defender, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't when you're playing against that system. So tomorrow night will be an interesting one as well, or tonight, should we say, wherever it is, against Stoke City. Because Luke Shaw, I'd imagine, is going to play left back. Shaqiri, is he probably going to play on the right hand side for Stoke City? Is he going to trap back Luke Shaw? So there's a lot of attacking impetus within that United team now.
And it sounds like United have done pretty much only, you know, possession and gameplay type stuff while they've been in Dubai. Loads of fun, loads of energy, loads good. Really relaxed. So I am expecting that United do come out tonight and go all guns blazing. And I think there's an excellent opportunity while he's chaos at Stoke to really pour a bit of misery on them, really, but to really cement the hard work they've done last week in Dubai, because can you imagine all this positivity that they're riding and we get a 0-0 draw or something? Not even lose, just a 0-0 at home.
Yeah, I think the big thing is if you look at United in particular at home, it's a lot of late goals that they do score, you know, and that's not because they're not a good team. It's because teams are showing that much respect that they're sitting deep and saying, listen, if we can get a 0-0 later, jobs are good. And everyone talks about it, and it's one thing that does frustrate time. Everyone goes, oh, look at Mourinho, last minute goals to win a game. Well, who invented Fergie time?
Do they not count as long as they're in the 90? I don't think you get any more or less points if you score in the first 5 minutes of the last five, do you? So
listen, Ferguson, greatest manager Manchester United have ever had. What he'd done, one of the greatest managers in world football ever. But at times, it took them to the 90th minute to get the winner. But they kept going. Because if you're getting 10 men behind the ball, I remember at times going to Manchester United, and it was just wave after wave after wave of attack. And it was like, wow, what's just happened there? And before you knew it, it could be 2-3-0, but there'd be other times where you're hanging on, and then that will get you eventually. It's because what happens is the reason that your top teams, and we're seeing it with Manchester City as well, the reason the top teams score a lot of late goals is because they've completely exhausted the opposition. When you get tired, people go, oh, your legs go, when you're tired, you can't get there. That's nothing to do with it. More often than not, it's your mentality. It's your concentration. That's the first thing that goes. So all of a sudden, when you see, oh, Man United or Man City or whoever it is have scored a goal to win the game in the last minute, just look at the left back there. He hasn't got the legs to get back in. It's nothing to do with that. It's because he's starting to get tired, and the first thing that switched off is his concentration. He hasn't had the presence of mind to get in there. And that's the beauty of it. You know, people could be looking and going, oh, yeah, look at all the late goals, Man United. Well, I could turn on his head and go, yeah, well, look at the late goals they've got. If they hadn't have got that, so that means that they keep going all the way till the end. And that's what your great teams do. Manchester City have shown that as much as anybody this season.
Yeah, that was another criticism of Lukaku early in the season. He only scores late goals. We're like, hang on, isn't it a plus for Lukaku that a guy that size
he only gets
still
half
got
a goal
the
for
steam
that.
To go in the last minutes?
He only gets half a goal for that. It don't count. I think the one thing that you see anyway, and this isn't just attributed to Manchester United, I think it's attributed to any of the top clubs and any of the top players. I just think when you need to spend more time admiring them and appreciating them instead of looking at the weaknesses. You know, every player in world football will have some type of weakness, but let's not concentrate on that. Let's concentrate on the fact they are unbelievable players. Everyone keeps comparing Messi and Ronaldo. Don't do it. Just appreciate the unbelievable fact that we have two players that are the best that this world has ever seen, that are competing at the same time.
They're probably going to end up being one and two of all time once they retire. But 50 goals a season is going to go back to being ridiculous in a couple of years.
And I know, but we still, a lot of people still find the need to compare them. Oh, well, Messi's better than this, or Ronaldo's better. No, forget that. Let's admire them for what they are, which is two unbelievable footballers that we're probably not likely to see for a number of generations again, instead of looking at which one's best because this one's weaker at that. And I think we need to do that more instead of looking at players and instead of concentrating on the weaknesses, let's look at a lot of the strengths, because there's a lot to be admired about the top footballers in world football. Football is getting quicker and quicker all the time, so therefore players have to become more clever. It's becoming more tactically in depth, so therefore players have to be more switched on the pitch. The amount of times you'll see systems change 2 or 3 times in a game. So let's concentrate on the positive side of things. And this isn't me just talking about Man United, it's me talking about all the teams. Concentrate on the positivity and what players do bring to the game instead of what they can't bring, because I think it's ridiculous.
A couple of years ago, I watched the full 1968 European Cup final.
Watched that numerous times.
Have you watched the quality of the football, though? You would be punching holes in a telly if that was...
I know.
I'm not going to say it, but, you know, go watch it. Go watch it and put it in the comments what you actually think.
The commentary is brilliant. My favourite video when I was a kid was a George Best story. It was, and it had the, like, you know, loads of highlights on there from you know, my oh my, how they cheered Kid the Birthday Boy, and were United finished, not on your life. Bobby Charlton made it 4, and then George Best when it was Eusebio, wasn't it? He went through and he had the shot.
Yeah, Stepney saved from a point blank range. And Stepney saved it,
and he went up to him, cuddled him, and things like that. Bobby Charlton, how he got that goal in from that obscure angle is just bizarre. And then George Best beating the keeper, and then the keeper diving into the goal as it's put over the line. So, you know, they were unbelievable. You know, it was great, because obviously what had happened at Munich and the Busby Bays, and to do that 20 years later, and it was a team that Sir Matt Busby built, and it's a legacy that will never be forgotten. And players, I would love to have seen. I know you can never recreate it, but I'd love to have seen George Best playing that. I'd love to have seen George, but Duncan Edwards players like that, because like I can only listen to my dad when he talks about them. And I used to say to him, I said, Duncan Edwards, because obviously my dad, you know, he was born in the early 40s. And I asked my dad, I said, Duncan Edwards, I said, you know, where'd you put him with Robson and Keane? He went, combine the two of them. I was like, wow, that good. And he's like, yeah, he was phenomenal. George Best.
He come third in the Ballon d'Or couple of months before he died at 20 as a defender. It's unheard of, especially then. That tells you he was getting the respect around Europe.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously he was worshipped in Manchester.
Yeah.
And yeah, my granddad's the same. My granddad, his first game was 1950. He was in Old Trafford on the day the disaster happened. He was working in a tool shop just off Ayres Road near where the Metrolink station is now.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, Edwards was the one. He goes, it sounds really bad. He goes, but as the names was coming in, everyone was just going, just please not Edwards. Just please not Edwards. But yeah, I think that's confined to the history books, I think, how good that is. There's an excellent book. Have I got it here? I have, but I can't reach it. By James Layton, called The Greatest. If you've not read it,
I
definitely recommend reading it. It's amazing. Okay, yeah.
I'll definitely have a look at that. But yeah, it's speaking to my dad about it and things like that, and you know, obviously the stories, and then Sir Matt Busby then winning the European Cup 20 years later, the game after.
I've got that here actually.
The blank programs and things like that. So it's awful. It is awful, but it is part and parcel of Manchester United's history.
It's who we are, isn't it? I'm sorry for everyone that crinkling. I've got it here actually.
Wow, that's incredible.
One of my other favourite programmes as well, FA Youth Cup Final 1992.
I think, who was that against? That wasn't...
Palace.
Palace. I was at that game. How many... At the home game, there was about 30-odd thousand there, wasn't there?
I wasn't there, my dad was there, so I wasn't there. Sure, it was my dad's programme.
Wow, I'm sure it was there for that, because they played Leeds a little bit later on as well, didn't they?
That was the following year when Scholes was captain, I think. We lost. But it's one of the videos I want to do, actually, like a little documentary I want to do, is I want to get all of these lads, Pilkington, O'Kane, Switzer, Casper. I think I'll probably never get Beckham. But I would love to go and get, you know, give me a one-liner to the camera about what you thought your career was going to be at this game, and are you glad with how it turned out? And I mean, I think Giggs, probably say no. Actually, it'd be like, now there's a couple of times I thought I could have won more titles, maybe. I think there's going to be some really interesting answers to that, and I'd just love to get it all signed.
You're never going to see that again.
Nah.
You're never going to see that again, ever. I don't care what anybody says. I think, first of all, you've got to give credit to Sir Alex Ferguson, obviously, finding the players, nurturing the players, but then getting rid of the players that he got rid of in the summer and entrusting the young players.
Well, from an FA Youth Cup win to a Champions League win in 5 years.
I know. And
7 years, 7 years.
But then you look at Manchester United, that's what they've got to get back to. They've got to get back to bringing through young players, because Manchester City, you've got to give them credit, they're doing well with that, you know, their scouting network and things like that. Manchester United, because that was one of the first things that Sir Alex Ferguson did when he came into the football club.
He said, this is crap, we need to fix it. Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit of your take. You just bent Sir Alex's ear off on a train, didn't you?
It was unbelievable. I was just coming home on the train, because I have a show that I do every Friday on Sky, 10 to 12, and I saw him, and he was just waiting on the train. He was like, I was just sitting at the back out of the way, and I walked past him, just said hello and what have you, and I just walked past him for, you know, leaving to it. And he invited me over, just said, you know, come and sit down, and we just spent 2 hours just talking, just me and him.
You think, and just praying for a delay near Macclesfield. Like, come on, just like a signal failure or something. Let's just sit here for another 8 hours.
But it was brilliant. And, you know, it's really different now, because obviously I spent time as a kid there. You know, I didn't play that many games for the first team there, but he was my manager there, regardless of whether I played for his team or not. He was the main man. And then when I left the football club, you know, I was a player of opposition teams that would go to Old Trafford, or he would come to our ground, and so he was the opposition manager. But this was just so different. It was just two people talking about football, and he still has the aura about him. It was just, I'm one of these people that when I'm in the presence of somebody that I think has unbelievable knowledge, if we chat for 2 hours, I spend about 10 minutes talking, that's it. Because I just wanted to take it all in, and he was just talking, he's like a granddad. He was just talking about...
I can't imagine how much of a treat that is. What would you have paid for that? Like, if someone said to you, you can have Sir Alex Ferguson, like, a captive audience for 2 hours, just to let him just yarn on about stuff.
He's just unbelievable, but he doesn't forget anything. One of the first things he said to me was, I remember when you broke your leg. That was 22 years ago. And I was a snotty-nosed first-year apprentice. And it was just brilliant. We were just talking about anything and everything, you know, about having drive, about the fact of, you know, when they'd won the first Premier League, it was like, we knew we were untouchable. And that just actually gave me goosebumps. I was like, oh, my God, imagine being part of a dressing room and a manager that knew you were untouchable in the Premier League. Just untouchable, just knew it doesn't matter who you're up against, you could deal with it. And the one thing, like, everybody talks about growing up at Manchester United and says, well, what's the biggest thing you got from it? What did you learn footballing-wise? I learned how to conduct myself and how to be later on in life and things like that, because when you used to go out training and you were fortunate enough to train with the first team, you know, in the mid to late 90s, it was full of world-class players. But the way they were on that football pitch, it was like there was 3 points at stake. Mm. You know, you had Gary Neville and Phil Neville. We were apprentices at the time. So we were first-year apprentices. And every Thursday we had day release for college. But that was the only day off we'd have. And the rest of the time, we probably used to get an afternoon off on a Wednesday every 2 weeks. So we'd be in the shower. Next thing, Gary Neville, who's now cemented himself, I think it was probably about 96, he'd cemented himself in the England team and in Manchester United's first team. And Phil Neville was well on his way to doing it. They'd put the red round the corner and go, right, lads, we're going on Wembley for heading practice. And you were like, and I just want to have an afternoon off. But then after you'd done that for a couple of months, it was like, if it's good enough for them, it's got to be good enough for you. And
wasn't that part of the thing that Cantona brought? It was like he would grab a couple of them and get out on the pitch and be like, right, I'm doing this extra training. And eventually the whole team ended up doing extra training.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was the characters within the football club as well. The characters, the players within the football club, they were all like, it was as though they'd win a game and then it was forgotten then, right? It was the next game's coming along. And I was fortunate because I think probably when Cantona got banned, I was like, obviously like an apprentice at the time, I think, and you'd come and train with us when the first team had games. And it was just genius. It was just brilliant. But he was an ultimate trainer as well. You know, you'd like see him like kicking a ball against the wall and training things like that. And you'd be like, he doesn't need to do that. He's that good, but he was practicing his first touch. And I was just, phenomenal. These players were just unbelievable. And like when I was a kid, so under-11s, under-12s at the School of Excellence, everyone talks about Beckham's free kicks and the ability he's got, and it's a God-given, it's a God-given talent that he's got. It's not. You know, he worked on that. So when we were 11 and 12 years old, so the class of 92, they'd be like first-year apprentices. They'd come and train with us on a Monday evening after being doing their apprentice work during the day. And they'd come and join in the five-a-sides with us. And in the cliff, the goalpost closest to the exit door to go out had two tyres in it. Had two black tyres in each corner, each top corner. We would leave, training would be finished at 8 o'clock. Beckham would get two bags of balls, put them 25 yards out, and all he'd be doing, bending them through the tyres. That was at the age of 16. So he knew what he wanted to do. You know, that's hard work. And it didn't just happen. No one just said, "Here, David Beckham, this is your right foot." He just worked on it. And I used to see that with every single player. And for me, it was just, listen, I was never good enough to be part of that football team. They were unbelievable. I'm the first one to hold my hands up. But what I learned from that was actually seeing world-class players and seeing that no matter how good they were, they always wanted to improve. They always wanted to be better. And it was just a fantastic time in the football club. And my upbringing was brilliant because of it. There was, fools weren't suffered. And you saw that, and that's what every single first team player, they give as good as they got, and it was a joy to watch, to be involved in on a few occasions. It was great for my upbringing, and it really set me up for later on in my career. You know, I did as much as I can, probably overachieve, but that's because I always felt to myself to not give everything, whether it be training or whether it be a match, is to let yourself down. And it was a great upbringing and a great lesson for me at United at an early age.
You said your loan out at Antwerp turned you from a boy into a man. You played pretty much the full season there, didn't you? Mm. And I think obviously Ronnie Walworth was there with you. Was Twiss
Jamie
out
Wood.
There as well?
There no, was Jamie Wood was out there with us.
There's tons of you, weren't there?
Yeah, at the time, I was the first ever one to go over. Jim Ryan pulled me one day and just said, you know, we've got this connection with Royal Antwerp and we think it'd be good for you to go over. And because Man United, I believed, and was proven to be the case, you know, don't do things just for sake of it. They do it for what they believe is going to be advantageous for the player. I went along with it. It was a real up and down time. More good than bad, but a lot of life lessons. So we went out there. The team wasn't doing great. And my first three games, we lost the first one, I think 1-0. It was live on TV in Belgium. I gave a penalty away at their local rivals. So that wasn't the greatest of starts. The second game, I think we lost 2-0 at home. And then the third game, I'm not kidding you, we should have won 8-5 and we got beat 5-0. So we're on the bus on the way back. And as the bus has pulled up, I'm at the back, like I'm snotty nose, 19-year-old, I think? Yeah, 19-year-old.
Were you the only red out there at the time as well then for them?
Yeah, I was there. I was there for 3 months on my own, just living in a hotel. And Flemish is a tough language to learn and an even tougher language to understand. So I'm on the bus and on the way back and there's loads of fans waiting. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, tell you what, they travel in their numbers and they wait for us as well. That's absolutely brilliant. So all the players have got off. I'm the last one off. Oh, they went for me. They went for my throat. You, piss off. Go back. Go back to England. Go back to England. All of a sudden, it was like, you come from Manchester United. You should be able to do everything right and things like that. And the manager's wife came out the bus straight after me. And she went, come here. Come with me. So I've come out of the way. And she went for the fella. It was basically, I was like, he was, what, maybe 35, 40 years of age. And I'm like a 19-year-old kid. And he's just come for me full barrels. If he could have hit me, I think he would have done. And she just pulled me and she said, come on, come over here with me. And then the manager could come over to me, took me in there in his office, said, listen, I want you to come out for a meal with me tomorrow. I went, I want to go home. I don't have been there. Said, I want to go home. I said, I'm in a country where I'm in a hotel on my own. I can't speak a word of the language. I don't understand what anybody's saying. You know, this is a real shock for me and I can't do it. I want to go home. And he said, you need to come out for a meal tomorrow with me and my wife. So we'd lost the three games. And I said, I'll come out for a meal. I said, but then afterwards, I said, the club needs to sort me out or he needs to speak to him because I'm going home. I'm not staying there. I was adamant. I spoke to mum and dad and my mum said, yeah, come home. So my dad's like, get a grip, get on with it. No old schools. Yeah. I'm like, all right, cheers, dear dad. So I've gone out for a meal with the manager, Reggie Van Acker, and his wife. And we sat down. He said, Danny, he said, will you give me – three games. You've been here three games, give me three more. If things do not change round, I will personally drive you to the airport and I will pay for your flight home. And his wife was there as well. And his wife was like really motherly as well to me because, you know, I was still a kid going over there. And she was like, go on, do it. And I was like, I don't want to. And he said, three games, just give me three games. So I was like, okay, I'll give you three games. We won the next 12. And we were second in the league at Christmas. And I think three games afterwards, so we'd won then three games in a row. We played a team away from home. And I think it was a team called Dainzer. And Antwerp had an unbelievable following. Wherever you go, they take 3,000-4,000 without doubt. And so we're in the dressing room at the end of the game and everyone's like celebrating. And all of a sudden you heard a... It's like, no one knocking on the door. There's no one banging the wall. And I just kept hearing this. Right, like around me, so I thought, it sounds like it's above my head. So I've looked up, there's a glass ceiling, and the fella that wanted to punch me was taking all his clothes off on the roof of this dressing room. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's just like doing a striptease, and I'm thinking, is he doing a full Monty or something for a bit of a joke? And he's crying, he's visibly crying. He's taking his top off, taking his pants off, still got his shorts on, and he's got all these Antwerp tattoos. And he's just pointing at him, then blowing me kisses. So I've got change, gone outside, and he's come up to me, just give me the biggest hug, and he went, Danny, I must apologise. So this football club, as it is for many supporters, it's our life, and we put too much on you. And, you know, he just gave me a big hug, was crying his eyes out. And from that second onwards, I ended up becoming like a bit of a figurehead at the football club as in terms of what was going on the pitch. And It was incredible. So that made me grow up. But not just that, the war was going on in the former Yugoslavia at the time. So we had 18 different nationalities there. We had a number of players that were on both sides of the fence who couldn't get in touch with their loved ones, couldn't get in touch with their mums, their dads, their brothers, their sisters, aunties, uncles, couldn't get in touch, didn't know whether they were dead or not.
Was that an atmosphere in training or was that?
No, it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. The fact of you had these people from both sides of the fence, for all we know, a member of one family could have killed a member of another family.
Or all of it.
Yeah, it was, it brings shivers down my spine just to see the humanity amongst them. And every day it was news. They couldn't get any news. They couldn't get in touch with anybody at home. And it was really emotional. For a 19-year-old kid to be seeing that, it sort of put my problems in terms of I can't speak Flemish. Or I'm in a hotel that just keeps serving me cordon bleu every night. Just put it into perspective. And it was brilliant on a football level, but growing up level as well.
It nearly wasn't though, was it? Because Ronnie Warwick had a bit of a run-in with a referee and you, luckily, got found innocent after a little bit of a mess around, but you was dragged into a right load of shit with Ronnie Warwick as well. Ronnie got banned for life and you got a year ban initially. Was that right?
Right. I think basically what happened,
I think it was signed die, yeah. It was life, I think.
Okay. And I got 2 years in Belgium and a year in England. Now, for me...
Did you have to phone Fergie like,
It was incredible. And I will tell you, if you've got the time, I'll tell you the story of this from start to finish because it will make your jaw drop.
Go it. We'll wrap up on this. So, go on. Throw this one.
Right. So, we'd got into the playoffs and we'd played a team called Turnout at home. We'd been beaten 2-1 and our fans had rioted after the game. So, we then were due next to play Le Louvier. And Le Louvier was the French side of Belgium. And there was a real rivalry between the fans. The Le Louvier's fans had started on us. They waited outside our bus and they tried to get us all when we played them previously. And our fans had known about it and they were waiting for them the next game. So, we had to play this game behind closed doors. And it was bizarre because as we're driving towards this ground, you'd probably say it was similar to a non-league ground where this ground had, because nobody wanted us to be at their ground because of the trouble that had been caused and what have you. So as we're driving, all the shutters of all the houses that they've got shutters like in this country, they're all down. It was just like a ghost town. So we've got to the ground and we go
there's
out.
There's a lot of aggro actually in Dutch and Belgian football, isn't there? Hooligan.
Yeah, there is. And they don't do it by off measures, or they didn't at the time. So we're out warming up and we're playing Le Louvier and there's not a fan in sight yet. We can hear hundreds of Antwerp fans singing. I'm looking around, stopped in the middle of one, I'm thinking to myself, where's this noise coming from? And like, we were playing, no word of a lie, we were playing in the middle of a forest, we had these massive trees, and all of a sudden the wind got up. So as the wind got up, you looked into the trees, and all you saw it was red shirts everywhere. There was hundreds of fans in the trees. They were so much into Antwerp. So anyway, towards the end of the game, we're playing Louvier, and we knew that realistically we needed a point or 3 points to remain in the playoffs. And about 3 minutes into injury time, their player's gone through, scored, the referees give the goal. He was about 7 yards offside. That's not being exaggerating, it was a joke. So we're arguing with it. The referee, Anshion, I'll never forget his name, he gave the goal. So we're, at the end of the game, we're then walking into the tunnel. And this went on to help me later on in the case. So as we're walking in, you remember the old advertising hoarders that used to spin round? So you'd have one on. So I'm walking in and I've lost my head. I've put my foot through the advertising hoarding. This has been caught on television. I couldn't get my foot out of the advertising hoarding. My foot was stuck. My foot was stuck in there. So all the lads had gone into the tunnel. I'm oblivious to what's going on. I'm there trying to get my foot out. I get my foot out. Then it takes about another 2-3 minutes to get my boot out. So I then walk into the tunnel and I've just walked into absolute mayhem. It's going off left, right and centre between our players, between their players. There's a cameraman for their team taking endless photos of our players getting into fights and that. And Jamie, one of our lads, if I remember right, I just said, Jamie, said he's taking photos of everyone. And Jamie didn't care. Jamie went and hit him. He's
the photographer. Next.
Yeah, who was just some random photographer because he was taking photos of everyone. He's obviously against us big time. So I think Jamie's at him. He's then come at Jamie, allegedly, with a knife, allegedly.
Fucking hell.
Got rid of him, so that's done and dusted. And then everything eventually calms down. We then go to walk into our dressing room, which is in, as you're walking in, it bears off to the right. It's in the far right-hand side. And the goalkeeping coach is now having a set-to with the referee. Ronnie sees that, shoves our goalkeeping coach out of the way, goes for the referee, doesn't hit him, doesn't punch him, don't do anything. I get older, Ronnie, and say, Ronnie, what are you doing? Stop, Ronnie, push him into the dressing room. Everything's done. So that is the be-all and end-all of what happened. So we then get back to the hotel. Belgian FA have sent a fax to Paul Bistio, who I think was the secretary of the club at the time, and said that me and Ronnie immediately had to go home. We'd been banned. So I'm thinking, well, Ronnie, okay, maybe to a certain extent, but nothing major, maybe manhandling the referee. But I've, like, pushed Ronnie out of the way. So we've gone into the dressing room. I've then obviously had to fly home. And we flew home a couple of days later after the next game. We were banned anyway. And we've got in. Sir Alex Ferguson's pulled us in, asked for our version of events, gave them to him.
How scary was that, by the way?
Yeah, it was tough because...
Even though you know you didn't really do anything, it's still...
We knew our future was in the balance because we didn't know what the future held us in terms of being banned. And he pulled us into his office. And he'd known me and Ronnie since we were 9. He knew that, yes, we would be tough on the pitch, but we didn't do things like that. He didn't have plays at his football.
What was it he was accused of doing, actually? Because he was accused of assaulting the referee.
I was basically, Ronnie was accused of, I think, punching him. And then I was accused of picking him up and headbutting him after strangling him somewhere along them lines.
Classy move.
Yeah, classic move, yeah, flipping it. But what it's worth in the miver that you went through, it was probably going to be worth it, allegedly. But no, so nothing happened. Listen, it's years down the line now, so I'm more than happy to tell the truth. It's not going to affect anything to do with me. So Sir Alex Ferguson sat us down and he just said, you know, asked about the situation. We told him the situation and he said, listen, that's first things I want to do is offer you both new contracts. Last thing I expected, because he knew we were innocent. He knew that our parents were obviously a little bit worried at the time. He knew that we were fearful of the rest of our career, and he offered us both new 4-year contracts, which was it meant so much to me, meant so much to my parents as well, because we didn't know what direction everything was going in. And he come over with us to the Glass House, which is basically the Belgian FA. They just won the treble. He's building a team to try and cement that and try and go again. And he took time out to fly over to Belgium to be with a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old and a 21-year-old that had probably made, one appearance between us was in terms of substitute appearances. And he sat there and we had an interpreter, we had a referee and linesman that were there. And they just they spoke complete and utter rubbish. They just lied about us, said what I'd said, that I'd grabbed one of them by the throat. Ronnie had headbutted him, I'd punched them. They had photographic evidence. With a mark around the neck like that, which was basically to where the cameraman got re-involved again. Later down the line, I was told how much truth there was in it. I don't know that the linesman had done that to the referee to create a photo. And he was FIFA. Yeah, no, he was FIFA listed at the time. So it was two young lads
and a FIFA were ref, yeah.
against the FIFA ref. So our bans were extended. So we went out of there, and I was just like, "That's it. That's my career over." Then he refereed one game, first game of the season in the Belgian league, and it was 6-6. He was interviewed live on national television. He blamed me and Ronnie. He said that mentally, you know, I still have nightmares about Ronnie Walwork and Danny Higginbotham, and it's affecting me. So the Referees Association backed him up. A few weeks later, he refereed a game, which was 1-0. There'd been a lot of goings on, I think.
Was it 5-6 or 6-6?
The 6-6 one.
Didn't he give five or six penalties in that game?
There was something really stupid. It was something really stupid, pathetic, and he was questioned about it. And then a few weeks later, he did a game which was 1-0 and gave a goal or disallowed a goal. Should have either never been given or never been disallowed. And he was told to go and get psychiatric help. And our bans were quashed. But what made it worse at the time was that...
But the bans were quashed because there was evidence come out proving what he said was bollocks, wasn't it?
I think it was. I had 16 character witnesses that had said that, you know, I hadn't done the things that I'd done. There was too much rubbish in there, but they'd given him the benefit of the doubt because he was FIFA listed. The minute that he started to do some bizarre things, that's when they started to question him, and that's when things didn't add up, but they gave him the benefit of the doubt first. Well, probably the more frustrating thing for me was that with Ronnie, because his ban was considerably longer than mine, they got his license. Yeah, well, yeah, done. He was
gonna be- Lifetime's pretty long.
Yeah. they kept his license so we could carry on playing while the court process was going on. But because mine was going to be shorter, they said, listen, just do your bit of time now. So then when we believe it will be quashed or we will believe it will be a less sentence, you will have done a lot of it now. So I was like, okay. And then Sir Alex Ferguson pulled me before they played Liverpool at Anfield, and he went, probably not a great thing to tell you, but if you weren't banned, you'd have been involved today. Yeah, because there was illness and injuries, and Ronnie came off the bench. So it was bittersweet, but listen, I always believe I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from that, as in terms of, you know, what a club that Manchester United is, the things that people within the football club will do for you if they believe in you, how that you hope justice eventually comes to the fore. And I look back at my time in Belgium as nothing but positivity, because everything that happened, whether it be good or bad, was a big lesson for me. And it was fantastic, and I would recommend it, because I know there's a big spotlight about players going abroad, young players. I would recommend it to anybody.
Well, there's been a bit of a generation of players with Sancho and Matty Willock and Chris Willock and that, all sort of getting out there and getting some foreign experience in, even the likes of Dyer coming from Sporting Lisbon. I think it definitely enhances the games of the young lads that we've got, because there isn't enough English talent that's going abroad and proving themselves, I don't think.
You are mollycoddled to a certain extent here. So I went over to Antwerp. We all had our own ball. We all had our own ball, and you had to wash it after training session. This was the first team.
That's absolutely mint.
Had your own number. Yeah, but it wasn't mint, because there was a river next to the flipping training ground. So if you had a bus stop or a bus stop at one of the other players, you know your ball was getting smashed into the river.
How many
you had
times
to go and
did
fetch
people
it.
Literally say, I'm taking my ball on?
But you had to wash it. So every day there'd be a bucket, and you was in a queue, and you had to wash that ball, and that was your pride. That was your pride and joy. That ball gets lost, you're getting fined, and you've got to pay for a new ball. And it was something that I'd never had to do before as an apprentice, but can make you treat like scum of the earth. You know, you had to do the job, but I love nothing more than, like, I was cleaning Brian McClair's, Roy Keane's boots. I love nothing more than coming home and telling my mates I was cleaning their boots.
I don't think it happens at all now, does it?
No.
It's a kit-match job, isn't it?
Well, one of my last years at Stoke, the kit man came in to us, and we said to him, "said listen, lads' boots haven't been cleaned in 3 days in pre-season." I said, "What's going on?" "Oh, there's a new rule. You've got to actually go and see the academy lads and ask them if they'll clean your boot and boots and ask them and tell them how much you're going to give them." He's like, "I'm not having that. We'll give you the cash. You clean our boots." He's like, "That'll do me." It's shocking. Listen, it's not the be-all and the end-all, but
is that because academy players now have got a monetary value on them?
I just think it's probably seen as not the right thing to do, but I couldn't disagree more, because you were put in situations. At United, I had to do the drinks. and we train in one area, the first team would train in the other. I couldn't start training until I'd seen Peter Schmeichel take a drink of the drink, because if it was too weak or too strong, it was getting thrown on the floor and I knew I had it. So I had to make sure that I did my job properly. But it's all or anything. And the biggest thing is that there was a connection. There was a connection with me as a 16-year-old and someone that was 24, 25 at the top of their game, playing for the national team, one of the best players, world-renowned footballers, because they'd been in that situation before. So you had something in common. So it wasn't, oh, wow, I remember that goal you scored the other week, this time, whatever it was. Do you remember cleaning boots? Oh, yeah, and they tell you the stories about it. So all of a sudden, there was something that bonded you. And it was the same with the lads that had broke through to the first team. The likes of Giggs, the likes of Beck, and the likes of Scholes. It was quite recent for them, so they would actually come and talk to you about it and their experiences doing it. There's no connection now between senior players and academy players because they've been brought up in completely different ways. So therefore, there's an element of dysfunction between the two sets. Whereas, like for us, whether it would be us going to train with the first team, we'd spoken to first team players before we'd actually go and train there, because you shared something in common. No matter how globally recognised they were now, there was a point in their life where they had actually been cleaning first team players' boots, where they'd actually been told that they were doing a bad job and by a foreman, and been told that if you don't shape up, there's going to be trouble. There was times when they'd made drinks for first team players where they'd had to clean rooms. You know, it was bringing Sir Alex Ferguson every couple of months. He'd come downstairs and say to lad, right, we're having a check of the training ground. This is at the Cliff. I'm putting a mark in the dust somewhere in the training ground anywhere. I'm going to come back in 2 hours and I'll see if it's been cleaned or not. And that was it. Sometimes you'd be there for 5 hours because you couldn't find that piece of dust.
But I did 7 years in the army. I had loads of that sort of shit.
But the way I look at it, people say, oh, we shouldn't be doing that, this, and whatever. But I believe it was fantastic upbringing to understand that. And the biggest thing for me was that it gave me a connection with the first team players, no matter how good they were, no matter how famous and working out.
I think that's something people don't really think of when they think of
that's the biggest
people
thing.
Cleaning boots. Because I think most outsiders' view of it is cleaning boots keeps them grounded and remembers that, you know, everyone starts at the bottom. But you're saying it's more than just that physical process of cleaning the boots. It's the fact that you can talk to them about
you've
that.
Got a connection.
You can instantly start forming a relationship.
You've got a connection. Brian McClare used to come in and would talk to me and go, I remember when I did these boots and things. Like, all of a sudden, you've got a connection. You've got something to talk about. I couldn't talk to him. Oh, yeah, I remember when we played last week in front of 50,000. You scored that winner. That was brilliant, that, wasn't it? Well, I had no understanding of anything like that. So it brought you down to the same level, and it created, I'm not saying a friendship, but it created this connection. So therefore, if you were fortunate enough to go and play with the first team, it wasn't as daunting because you'd actually connected with these people off the football pitch and off the training ground.
Awesome. Right, Danny, I think we're going to have to leave it there because it's going to take
no problem, mate.
Already. But Danny, thank you. This has been awesome. Make
no
sure you
problem,
go and follow
mate.
Danny on Twitter. I'll throw the link in the description below. And he's also on commentary tonight for United and Stoke. What's your prediction, do you reckon?
I think
Stoke don't have a manager, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You don't know what you're going to get. I think Stoke will try and dig in. I think defensively that'll be their most important thing. But if United can get an early goal, I think it'll make it a more comfortable one. I think the longer it goes in, you know, Stoke might have more belief. But I'm going to go for a United win. And then Stoke City's season begins after that. The next four games are huge. I think they've got Huddersfield, Watford, Brighton and Bournemouth. So they need to get the Manchester United game out of the way and get a new manager in. But I can't see anything other than 3 points for Manchester United.
Yeah, I'm thinking hopefully what we worked on last week in Dubai is going to pay off for us.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping for 3-0 for United. So there we go. That's what me and Danny are thinking. We're both thinking 3 points for the Reds. Make sure you go and give Danny a follow on Twitter. Subscribe if you're new around here. Make sure to hit the notification as well because YouTube's not telling everyone. And if you want to check out what I thought about the potential signing and where he might play of Alexis Sanchez, I'll link that video in the end as well so you can go and check that one out. And again, thank you to Danny. Thanks to you
no
guys
problem,
for tuning
mate.
In. And we will see you in the next one. Laters.